This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. In this portion of the program, we're going to hear about one of the worst battles of World War II. Thousands died. But this is a battle that is largely unknown, and it happened on U.S. soil. 3,000 Japanese soldiers invaded the Aleutian island of Attu in Alaska in 1942. In 1943, the U.S. retook the island. The invasion and the campaign to retake Attu were kept secret. Two guests join us this afternoon. One is a veteran of Attu. His name is Bill Jones. He served in the 17th Infantry Regiment, 17th Infantry Division, Company G. Also joining us this afternoon, Matt Radecki. He is one of the filmmakers of a documentary about the battle. The documentary is Red, White, Black, and Blue. Matt Radecki served as the film's director of photography. He is also one of the film's producers. The film tells the story of the battle largely from the points of view of Bill Jones and another veteran, Andy Petras. This is an excerpt from the film. Here the two veterans reflect on how they were affected by the war.
A lot of the things that I'd done were so out of the ordinary that certainly no civilian who hadn't even been in the military couldn't understand where we were coming from. And I just refused to talk about it. I had no reason, just shut up about it, that's all.
On the boat to be discharged was like 90 days before the war was over. I got up on the bow of the ship and early one morning, and for no reason whatsoever, I started to cry.
You have no thoughts about him or his family or anything else. You have a threat here that's got to be eliminated.
Although I didn't recognize anything at all prior to that, I just wondered, how can you stand and cry for an hour? Must have just sunk in.
One-track mind. So when you're a frontline infantry, you got a one-track mind. That's it. That's what you're there for.
I think combat has quite an effect on you mentally.
I have no regrets over any amount that I killed, and I was there to do a job, and I'd done the job the best of my ability. That's all I can.
That's like I said, nobody unless they've been there knows.
From the film Red, White, Black, and Blue. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guests, Matt Radecki and Bill Jones. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. WILL-TV will air Red, White, Black, and Blue tomorrow evening at 9 p.m. It's part of the PBS series, Independent Lens. Many other PBS stations are airing the program this month, so if WILL-TV is not your public television station, you'll want to check your station's program guide or newspaper TV listings. You can learn more about the film at the website www.alaskainvasion.com. Again, the phone number is 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Bill, Matt, welcome. So thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, thank you very much.
Oh, you're very welcome. How did the two of you meet?
Well, the director of the film, Tom Putnam, and I met our freshman year in college at USC, and one day Tom was telling me the story of the Battle of Attu, and I had grown up sort of a history buff and knew a fair amount about World War II, and I'd never heard of this battle before. And I told Tom, you know, if you're going to go to Attu, if you're going to make this film, I want to be part of it, you know, one way or another. And Tom did some research, and he met a Aleutian Island veteran organization that was run by a guy named Al King, and Al invited us to come to the reunion, which was held in Pigeon Forge, Tennessee. And Tom and I went with a camera and some lights, and I took my girlfriend, who's my wife now, with us, and the three of us met a bunch of veterans, including Bill Jones. And our interview with Bill was different than a lot of the other interviews that we did. That Ken Burns touched on this in the war, but during World War II, for every one fighting man, you know, frontline infantryman, there were 9 or 10 men and women supporting that person. So a lot of the people we interviewed drove bulldozers or, you know, were dispatch or did radio or communications or something. And Bill, being a frontline infantryman, had a very different story to tell. And we were sort of transfixed by the stories that he told us that day.
Yeah. Bill, what was it like meeting these young filmmakers?
Well, it was very enjoyable because finally, after 60 years, the Battle of Attoo was going to be told to the world through their film. And also far as I am concerned, terrible thing took place on Attoo in 1987. The Japanese were allowed to place a memorial on one of the most hallowed pieces of ground on Attoo called Engineer Hill. And I have been, since 2003, doing everything I can to get that memorial removed from that hallowed piece of ground on Attoo. I couldn't believe that any government office of the United States would allow such a thing to take place, but they did.
How do other vets feel about that monument that's there?
The same as I did. The Japanese, the scroll on the memorial reads, in honor of all, capital letters, parenthesis, all, the added is my say, of those who served in the seas, and the islands of the North Pacific in World War II and dedicated to world peace. I was up in Attoo in 2000, and when I seen that memorial, I couldn't believe it. And I was taken back. I was just amazed, appalled. I couldn't believe it. It took me till 2003 in June to determine what was wrong here. Those words were words of subterfuge. I say that because on Engineer Hill, the Japanese performed a banzai attack. Many of their soldiers were killed. They penetrated a clearing station, where they killed all of the soldiers in two tents that were wounded, and then finally set fire to one of them. Their commander was killed on Engineer Hill, and perhaps 400 to 500 Japanese were killed there or committed harakiri, that's suicide. That is the reason why the Japanese wanted that memorial on that hallowed piece of ground where so much American boys' blood was shed, not to honor all that served in the North Pacific during World War II.
Matt, what's your sense of that monument there?
Well, I come from a different generation, and I wasn't, I'm 35, and I think that it was probably the right intention for the Japanese to do what they did, but I think that it was extremely wrong that nobody contacted these veterans, who were very easy to find because we found them, and asked their opinion on it. And I think that another point that should be made is that there's this gigantic Japanese memorial on the island, and there was no official American memorial on the island. And Bill actually organized with this group of veterans the creation of an American memorial on the island, and that there should have been more interplay between the government and, the veterans that served there, and more of an effort on our government to recognize, our men and women that fought and died, in that battle.
Yeah. Bill, there is a moment in the film where you're at that marker.
Yes.
It's very moving. You're at the memorial to the U.S. dead, put in place finally, years after the Japanese marker went up in 87 or memorial. What was it like to see that marker and know it was there, it was in place?
You mean the one we put there?
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Al King of Sunrise, Florida, and I in 2000, he said, Bill, we've got to do something about this, meaning our government seemed fit to appease the Japanese by allowing them, authorizing them to put their memorial on Engineer Hill, but they didn't see fit to contact Congress to create a bill ordering, requesting, if you will, battlefield monuments to place a memorial on there for our men. We lost 579 American boys in that battle that lasted 19 days. 1,232 of us were wounded, some of us several times, myself four. 2,322 people, soldiers, suffered from climatic conditions, accidents, and sickness. And, as I said, the Japanese performed these atrocities on this Engineer Hill. And there's no question in my mind, it took me a long time from 2000 till June of 2003 to figure out why our government did this. They conned Bill Sheffield, the governor of Alaska at that time, into contacting the Department of Interior, who authorized the National Park Service and Fish and Game, an officer from the Fish and Game in Alaska, signed the document, the cooperative agreement, to allow that Japanese memorial to be there, regardless of what people think about its being right. Those of us that served on that island and shed our blood, and as far as I'm concerned, any American that could authorize this is over and above anything that I can imagine. If they knew any history, they knew no history of what took place there. The times that we went without food, the two blizzards that we went through, the cold weather, there's not a tree on the island. We had no place to sleep but on the ground for 19 days.
Mm-hmm.
We landed on Attu with clothes that the boys had on from the desert, Mojave Desert. And there were just so many things wrong with that whole thing. They landed bulldozers and trucks. Somebody should have known you can't use a bulldozer or a truck in tundra grass and muskeg. And also, they brought the wounded back through. They sent bulldozers up stream beds. The streams up in Oneatu are only like perhaps a foot deep normally. And they had to send bulldozers up there with a quarter-ton trailer behind them to bring back the wounded. They had to use human carrying lines to pass food up to the front lines as we progressed 3-4 miles inland. You could not use wheeled vehicles. You could not use bulldozers except in the stream beds. And to have gone through what the men went through, there are over 400 men lost a foot and or feet. And several others had other extremities that were frozen because of inadequate clothing.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said in the film, for the things that were done that shouldn't have been done and things that should have been done, there it was a horrendous experience.
You know, I think what I'd like to do now, with Matt's help here, is I'd like to play a piece or two from the film. What we're going to hear is a historian by the name of Mike McLaughlin talking about the battle and the weather, and we'll also hear the voices of some veterans, and I believe we'll hear Bill's voice among these veterans' voices, and then we'll hear a little bit about, you know, what the weather was like and what the fighting was like. Matt, you want to add anything to that?
No, I think that's accurate.
Okay, here we go.
The biggest factor in anything out on the Aleutians is always the weather. The weather controls everything.
It can go from being partly cloudy to having an absolute horrible snowstorm in about 5 minutes.
Our highest clocked wind speed is about 180 miles an hour officially.
You'll hear this every person that you talk to about the Aleutians. They'll talk about the Willow Wall, which is the Aleut name for hurricane.
It has snow, has rain, has fog, sleet, you name it, just got it.
It was a really a ridiculous thing as far as we were concerned. We had no training of anything like this.
There was absolutely nothing laying out there in the fog, looking at that fog.
And the fog up here would drop down to around the 50, 70 foot level, and then it would raise up to the 300 or 400 foot level.
And I can only imagine what it must be like when you're trying to wander around in that stuff. You have a mortal enemy that you're seeking out, and he is waiting for you to come his way.
They had built their defenses up on the side of these ridges. And when the fog came down, they couldn't see us. And then when the fog raised up, their snipers picked us off one by one. We lost many troops, just single troops at a time. We weren't in an assault mode or what have you. We were just walking around.
It's hard to understand if you're not out there and you're not engaged in the fighting to understand how fighting could take so long in such a short, small area. You have people fighting up 50 and 60 degree slopes. They're covered with snow. They're covered with rock. And essentially it was small unit action. It was squad by squad. Guys fought for every inch of the terrain.
And there, the voice of Mike McLaughlin, historian. And we get a sense there of what the fighting was like and what the conditions were like, what the terrain was like. And this goes back. Now let's get some background here. This was an invasion and a battle that were kept secret. The invasion took place less than a year after Pearl Harbor. So I think here we can assume why it was important to keep this secret. There was fear that the American public would panic. I'd like the comments of the two of you. Do you think the news of this Japanese invasion would have panicked the American public?
Bill is probably best to answer that. I wasn't around.
Right, I know. But you know, you've now been immersed in this history,
yeah.
Matt. So I was just kind of curious about what you'd think. But let's go. Let Bill go first.
Well, I'll tell you, I was like 19 years old,
mm-hmm.
20. I didn't think about things like that.
Yeah.
We had a General DeWitt who was responsible for the security of the West Coast. And, you know, we peons, we went where they told us to go. We didn't know anything about the big picture. We didn't know, you know, where we were going. Everybody in California, of course, I say that with tongue-in-cheek, everybody. Most of the people in California knew that the 7th Infantry Division, which is stationed at Fort Ord near Monterey, was in the Mojave Desert, and they were expected to go to North Africa where they would be up against Rommel. But I guess orders changed while they were there because they brought them back. I just joined the outfit. They were in the field 2 or 3 days after I joined the outfit at Fort Ord. They came in from the Mojave Desert, and shortly after that, we were loading aboard ship at St. Louis Obispo in California at San Francisco,
mm-hmm.
on our way to the North Pacific. The weather on that, too, you mentioned it earlier, the weather on that, too, hovered between 32 and 42 degrees while we were up there. As I said, two times there were blizzards, and I think they lasted about 24 hours.
I suspect that the secrecy surrounding the invasion and the battle, the campaign to retake the island, affected preparations for the battle. Does that go to help explain why that you weren't very well trained for this particular mission and folks were ill-prepared in terms of what the clothing was like and that heavy equipment that you mentioned, Bill?
Well, I don't know the big picture, of course. As I said, I was a private when we landed. 5 or 6 days later, our squad leader got hit on the foot with a Japanese mortar dud, and for some reason they gave me the squad to be the squad leader, and I was promoted to sergeant. But we had American soldiers in Alaska, and they had been using Alaska-type weather gear for years. I don't know what their excuse would be if you were asked the planners of the Battle of Attu why
they didn't have those clothing available to us when we got there. I don't have that answer. All I know is that most of us did not have winter clothing. Most of us had leather shoes on when they were using what they call snow packs in Alaska. And we received a long coat, about knee-length, reversible white and tan coat, which is not a conducive garment to wear when you're going to be in hand-to-hand combat with another human being. We did get goose down sleeping bags, which we crawled in with our dirty, muddy feet and clothing. And even though it was cold there and there was ice underneath of the tundra, we still, the body heat did get through there, and we were in mud in the morning when we woke up and just left the sleeping bag laying there. And I think we had double sleeping bags, so we took the inside one. But when you're infantry and you're fighting, especially when you're in close combat, you don't carry an awful lot of equipment with you. You can't fight with a pack on your back and anything that would hinder you from moving. So we carried nothing with us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that the secrecy issue was as much about to hide military planning as it was to offset panic in the general population. And they were worried that if a bunch of men were being trained, say in the mountains of California, word would trickle out and the Japanese would have a better idea of what was going on. And at the time, it was very important to maintain a level of secrecy, because this was very early in the war in Pacific, and we were still falling back. We weren't really on the offensive in the Pacific, and this was right around the same time as the Battle of Midway. So it was important for us to sort of keep our cards close to the vest militarily.
How did the Aleutians fit into the strategy of the Japanese?
Well, the concept was that by attacking the Aleutians, the Japanese would achieve a couple of objectives, one of which is that the Aleutians are strategically rather important where they are in the world. And you think about the Aleutians to be in the middle of nowhere, but then when you have to remember that during World War II, a lot of our aircraft were being built in Washington State, and from air bases in the Aleutians, heavy bombers could bomb Washington State. So even if they weren't necessarily putting men on the beaches, they could harass our production capacity, which is really the reason why we won, World War II. Also, the American government, even though they weren't directly involved in the European theater at the time, were providing a great amount of equipment to Russia through the Lend-Lease program. And most of our Lend-Lease shipments, especially the air ones, were going directly over the Aleutians. And finally, the idea the Japanese had was that if they had a presence in the Aleutians, we would split our forces and we would send, an aircraft carrier and all the support ships to the Aleutians. We had broken their code by that point, and we decided to keep our Navy together in the Pacific, which allowed us to fight them to at least a draw and probably a victory at Midway, which is really considered the turning point in the war in the Pacific. So it had many reasons to be important.
Yeah. In the end, was the campaign for Attu a battle of strategic value to the U.S. in the end?
Absolutely. We could not allow somebody to land on American soil and steal our soil. That's another thing that I have against this memorial, for whatever reason it is there. And along with that thought, I just a few months ago, 2-3 months ago, a member of the Department of Defense met with the Japanese on Attu with the thought that they are asking that they are allowed to exhume the remains of all of their soldiers in the different burial grounds on Attu. And as far as I know, that actually is taking place right as we talk.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guests this afternoon, two guests are with us this afternoon. One is a veteran of Attu. His name is Bill Jones. Also joining us this afternoon, Matt Radecki. He is one of the filmmakers of a documentary about the battle, the documentary Red, White, Black, and Blue. Our guest, Matt Radecki, served as the film's director of photography. He's also one of the film's producers. The documentary, Red, White, Black, and Blue, will air on our companion station, WILL-TV, tomorrow evening at 9 p.m. as part of the PBS series Independent Lens. And Independent Lens will be shown on many other PBS stations this month. They will air that this documentary that we're talking about this afternoon, Red, White, Black, and Blue. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk with a listener now. Someone calling in this afternoon from Eureka, Illinois, on line 4. Hi.
Hi. Very interesting program. It is my understanding that that part of the Aleutians was less than 700 miles from the most northerly point of Japan. Is that accurate?
Yes.
And I just have two other questions. I have seen a couple. I think I have my video files. I have a couple documentaries on Attu, and they also mentioned Kiska, I guess. And if my memory is correct, by the time that the American troops got to Kiska, the Japanese had abandoned that island. Is that accurate?
That's correct, that the Japanese captured the two westernmost Aleutian islands, Kiska and Attu. We actually skipped over Kiska and went directly to Attu, which was the beginning of the leapfrog policy that we did in the Pacific. In the middle of the night, this point about the weather is so important that in the middle of a night after the Battle of Attu, it was a dark, moonless, foggy night where you can't see anything, and the whole force of Kiska was evacuated on submarines. We eventually invaded Kiska, and based on our research, there were several American soldiers killed in the invasion of Kiska by friendly fire because it was foggy, it was mountainy, it was difficult to see, and somebody started shooting and people got shot and killed before we realized that the Japanese had evacuated it.
And if my memory is correct, there was also Dutch Harbor was bombed by the Japanese, I guess, from planes from Attu. Is that accurate?
June the 4th.
Pardon?
June the 4th, 1942.
And that was the only bombing of the Alaskan mainland. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, and the air war in the Aleutians is another fascinating story. That the pilots that flew there were some of the bravest men that fought in the war, because the greatest enemy was not the Japanese, but it was the weather. And in our research, we would read story after story about this pilot or that pilot, and who had hundreds of hours of experience and was one of the best pilots in the Aleutians, and they would take off one day, never to be found again. It was a terrible place for aviation.
On the documentaries I have seen it, and I'm sure, not having been there, and your guest who was there knows exactly what it was like, it just seems like one of the most godforsaken places on earth as far as the weather goes. Thanks very much.
Thanks for the call this afternoon.
I can inject something here. Right?
Sure.
In defense, perhaps, of the hierarchy of our military, the reason that I read that we were taken to San Francisco at San Francisco in our clothes for the climate of California was they were afraid saboteurs would see us loading if we had winter gear on, and then they would know that we were not going to Africa, that we were going to go north. Also, as I think most people know, nearly all of the Nisi and Niki Japanese on the West Coast were moved bag and baggage, had to leave their homes, they left with their suitcases, and they were moved to different camps throughout the United States. Some of them clear to the East Coast, I know, because I was where I lived in New Jersey. There was a camp there less than 20 miles away after I came home from the war. But I also read that of those saboteurs that they tried, not one Japanese person was found guilty of sabotage.
Let's take another call. A listener in Terre Haute, Indiana. Hi, line one.
Hi, I just have a quick question, and then I'll hang up because my phone is really messed up and I can barely hear you. Being in Terre Haute, I won't be able to watch the show. If you could tell me other places I could watch the show, and will it be on DVD? Because I am very interested in wanting to watch this. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, thank you for asking. That you can go to pbs.org and type in your zip code, and it will tell you when and where it plays in your area. Or if you'd like to buy the DVD, it is available on our website, which is www.alaskainvasion.com.
Okay, very good. Thanks for that call. And Matt, thanks for that information about the PBS website as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting things, and there's a place on it for veterans and for anybody to talk back on the PBS website. We've already gotten some interesting comments.
Yeah, what kinds of things are the two of you hearing?
Well, we've done a number of screenings, Tom and I and the other filmmakers, and one of the things that's always remarkable is at every screening, either a veteran shows up who served in the Aleutians, either during the campaign or afterwards, or we have a son or a daughter or a niece or a nephew that shows up with a handful of pictures from the Aleutians. And, you know, we had never heard of this, and it was sort of secret, and it was kind of hidden, but there were a lot of people affected by that, and by this campaign, and I think that, you know, these people finally are getting to hear more about what their, you know, fathers, their grandfathers, their uncles, aunts went through.
How long were the invasion and battle kept secret?
You know, that's a good question. There were newsreels created, especially after the battle was completed. So it wasn't, you know, unspeakable after the battle happened. But at the same time, things were moving pretty quickly, and I think that, you know, the next battle, the next story, what was going on in Europe, you know, D-Day, the next war, the next battle in the Pacific, sort of overwhelmed these previous stories.
Let's take another call. A listener in Normal, Illinois. Line 4, hi.
Hi. Did the matter of statehood, whether they were just territories at the time, do you think that affected the aggressiveness of the United States to respond? That's all I have. My comment.
Okay. Alaska was a territory at the time.
Well, from what the research we've done, in some ways the result of all this was Alaska became a state a lot faster, and a lot of Alaska's infrastructure was built in response to the Japanese attack, and that I don't remember the gentleman's name, but I believe that the territorial governor of Alaska and a general there got together and said, here's where we need roads, here's where we need airfields, and much of Alaska's infrastructure began during World War II.
Okay, very good. Let's take another call. Listener in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Hi. In passing a little while ago, you said that, referred to the Battle of Midway, and you said it was even or even a victory. And I had always, you know, had the image of Midway being a big victory, but you seem to qualify that. Could you elaborate that? Thank you.
I'm not an expert on the Battle of Midway by any means, but my understanding is that both sides took heavy losses during the battle, and it wasn't an outright victory, but it was the point in which we stopped the Japanese forward aggression, and in that sense, it was a victory. But I'm sure that there are hundreds of listeners out there who know far more about the Battle of Midway, so
yeah.
I don't pretend to be an expert on that at
Matt's
all.
Matt's a photographer,
not a
historian.
One of the greatest damages we did to the Midway was we sank 4 of their 6 aircraft carriers. And this can't help but partially cripple any nation.
Correct. It almost like balanced the scales in the Pacific, I think.
It was a turning point, definitely.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Bill, where else did you serve? After Attu, you weren't finished.
No, on the way up, they built up our ego by saying that as soon as the battle was over, they were going to send us back home with our sweethearts, and the newspapers would tell our stories and all of this. And after we came back from Kiska to, I believe it was ADAC,
and we stayed there for a time, and then we boarded ship, and as we left the dock, they played Blue Hawaii. Somehow or other, we knew we weren't going to go back to the lower 48, but we trained in Hawaii and went out to Kwajalein Island in the Marshall, and we came back to Hawaii after that, and then we went down to Los Negros, where MacArthur staged the Navy and the military, Army military units, and we headed for Lady Allen, the Philippines, and from there, about 4 days after the Battle of, after the battle was over on Lady, we sailed for Okinawa, where we landed Easter Sunday. Now, that's that was in the Eastern Hemisphere, not the Western. That was the day before it was, at Okinawa or Japan. Easter Sunday was a day sooner than it is back here in 48.
How did the action that you saw after Attu compare with what you experienced there in Alaska?
No comparison. Physically or otherwise, when I say physically, I mean by terrain. I mean, we were in jungle-type terrain in Lady in the Philippines. Okinawa, which I didn't get to land on because, a shell hit our gearbox and our alligator going into the beach, and we went back to the ship, and I came on home, was discharged. But nobody can ever forget what we on Attu went through, our bodies went through. In the movie, I say it's wonderful that youth can withstand shock, because we did stand shock, our physical being.
Mm-hmm.
We were exposed to the elements for 19 days. Several of us had one cup of hot coffee in 19 days, and no hot meals at all. 3 days, twice for 3 days, we went out without our K rations, which not that tasty, but of course they're nourishing. There's nothing. I've read a great deal since World War II of the different battles in the Pacific and some in Europe, and I just got to say, without prejudice, Attu is one of the most horrendous experiences any human being could take.
Yeah. You had youth on your side.
Yes.
But, as you say, I believe you say in the film, you were, this young New Jersey farm boy. You'd never imagined anything like this.
Neither did thousands of other boys right alongside of me.
How did you get from one day to the next, or did you?
You didn't think about it.
You didn't even think about it.
No, you just did what you had to do to live. That's all. At that age, you think differently, or you don't think as much, or as far ahead as you do as you get older. And you just took it one day at a time.
Mm. So, what was it like to go home finally?
Well, everybody's experience is different. As I said in the movie, I didn't feel that I was any different. I'd been out of combat since April, and I was discharged at Fort Dix, New Jersey, on July 14th. In the meantime, I had been in the hospital in Guam, in Hawaii. And how it affects you, I said in the movie, I didn't think that I was affected. But when I got up on the bow of that ship, and the sun was coming up over the bow, and I cried for an hour at the same time. And during other times about that period, I tried to conjure up a mental picture of my girlfriend and my family, and I couldn't do it. I was thinking, about if I don't recognize, but I did.
You were married pretty quickly after you got home.
10 days.
10 days.
Yep.
Yeah. When did you begin thinking about maybe you'd like to go back to Attu and see the place after the war?
In 1999, Al King from Sunrise, Florida, was a ex-Navy man who had garrisoned that too after the battle, and he took it upon himself to contact some veterans of the Aleutian campaign, and he took it upon himself to arrange for, you have to have a license to land on that too, and he had to coordinate with the United States Coast Guard out of Kodiak fly us out there. They only have one building out there, and they only have room for seven, perhaps 10 guests altogether. And he started in 1999, I believe, and to this day, I don't know how I found out about him. But that was probably sometime in July or August that I found out about him and called him and talked to him and made arrangements to go back to Attu with him. In 2000, this was. We went back in June of 2000. And that's how I met him. And then a lady from Oregon PBS called me and asked me if I'd be interested in going back to Attu to be part of a film. And I said, well, by coincidence, I'm going to be on Attu in June. So we met there, and another film was developed as a result of that. And that is when I seen that Japanese memorial for the first time. As I said, it bugged me for about 3 years until June of 2003 when I wrote my first letter to the governor of Alaska, Governor Frank Murkowski. That was my first letter of protest. And since then, I've written 129 letters, got four replies, believe it or not, from everybody from President Bush, Dick Cheney, Andy Card, Department of Defense, and Interior, of course, and State, Condoleezza Rice, and none of these personages, the senators, from the senator from Alaska, and the congressman, whose jurisdiction includes Attu, no answer. Don't even have the courtesy of a reply. One person in the office of the Fish and Wildlife of Alaska did answer my question, thanked me for my service, and indicated they had to deny my request.
Mm. Matt, what was it like for you and the crew to be on Attu with Bill and Andy Petras?
It was definitely like walking back into time for a couple of reasons. One, to have these wonderful guides who had lived this experience and had so many incredible firsthand stories to tell. But also, one of the things about Attu is that they've never cleaned up the island, and it is largely left as it was post-World War II. So there is machinery, there are shell casings, there are unexploded bombs. It's like a living museum. So to be able to have the people to tell the story and see the objects that were involved in it was fascinating.
Yeah, I want to play one more excerpt from the film. And it's an observation from a fellow by the name of Mike Haller. He's a major with the Alaska National Guard. And here he's talking about what it's like for veterans of the battle to return.
When they go back to the battlefield, there's something that you notice. There's an intentness, an alertness that comes into their minds and their hearts. That warrior thing runs very deep with them. You see it in the eyes of people who've actually fought hand-to-hand combat against a mortal enemy. And they saw people to the left and right of them die. So they've never, ever forgotten those moments. It's been something that's forever etched in their minds. It's hard to find a way to have peace in your heart and in your mind. It just is. It's a soulful thing, and it's a search that an individual has to go on. It's another journey, and it's beyond the battlefield.
And Bill Jones, let's give you the last word this afternoon.
Yes, I urge America to see the film Red, White, Black, and Blue. These young gentlemen that have done the filming and the sound and the production of this film, modern technology, of course, helped them. But they had the insight. They went to the archives in Washington, and they got actual films were taken in combat. And ironically, John Huston was one of the men that the government had employed to take combat pictures there. and something that made me wonder for a long time, how come John Huston, the movie mongol who made so many movies in the Central South Pacific, never decided to make a movie about the Battle of Attu. But what these young boys did, they took the picture, they set up their cameras on Attu and filmed the terrain on Attu. And then when they went back to their studio, they took the archival pictures and superimposed them on the same ground that they had taken pictures of when they were up on Attu. And it's just magnificent the way they were able to bring in today and yesterday. In some instances, I would point out a certain location where there were Japanese and or a cemetery, and they would superimpose the archival picture of where the cemetery was. And it's a very, very interesting film from that viewpoint, along with the fact that the world is finally going to find out about the Battle of Attu.
Mm. Well, Bill Jones, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon. And ahead of Veterans Day, thank you for your service.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And Matt Radecki, thank you for joining us this afternoon as well.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Matt Radecki is one of the filmmakers of Red, White, Black, and Blue. He served as the film's director of photography. He is also one of the film's producers. The film directed by Tom Putman.